With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Jaguar with the latest edition of Amazing Mets Alumni Conversations. We're pleasure to have the award-winning columnist from the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro, and Ed Lynch, former GM of the Cubs, former assistant GM of the Mets, former Mets player. Guys, we're here to talk about one of the most important days in Mets history, coming up to the 40th anniversary of the trade for Keith Hernandez, June 15th, 1983. Before we start, I want to tell you how I screwed this up right from the get-go. When Frank Cash called me, he said, "We've got a great player, Keith Hernandez, except one thing, he hates New York. He doesn't want to be here. Whatever you have to do to make it feel welcome, do it." So we're in Montreal. I come to the conclusion, let me get a big limousine. So I go to Montreal Airport, wait for Keith with my stretch limo, white limo. I went to the wrong gate. So I go back to the hotel in my limousine. Keith took a cab. I met him at the ballpark that day, and I apologized. Thank you for me. My relationship with him has gotten better. Mike, let me ask you this. I'm supposedly a historian with the Mets, and you know more about the Mets than I do. Right, the trade, we have Gary Carter, Mike Piazza, Lindor, Don Clendenin. How would you write the trade of Keith Hernandez, what it meant to the organization?
Yeah, I mean, to me, Jay, I mean, I think it has to be number one. Like, I mean, Clendenin's was huge because it was the kind of the final piece to make the miracle happen in 69. But you know what? I mean, they were still an expansion team. So, I mean, it was everything about that team was feel good up until that point, even though they were losing so much. The difference was by 83, the Mets had become just a disaster, as you well know. In New York, I mean, it wasn't just that they were terrible, but they had the Yankees, who had had a period of prosperity in their wake, so they had really reclaimed the town. And the Mets by 82, 83 were almost, beside the point in New York. Now, Mets fans didn't believe that, but, I mean, there were fewer and fewer of us, I think, back in those days. I was still in high school. So it was, we felt like a distinct minority in this town. And the fact is, I mean, I literally remember where I was when I heard the story. Another friend of mine who was a big Mets fan called me. And I thought he was pranking me, because how in the world would Keith Hernandez come to the Mets? Why in the world would the Cardinals trade him anywhere, let alone the Mets? And I mean, I didn't believe him for like an hour, and finally he was on the news, and I was stunned, And look, I mean, that's from a fan standpoint. From a baseball standpoint, he was the first important piece. All due respect to Ed and the other guys who were already there. They were
being part that's of the okay.
process, but I mean. He came with gravitas. He came with an MVP award. He came with a World Series championship, and with a seriousness that you can even tell just from the stands that he brought to the field every day. And look, I mean, it wasn't like the Mets won right away that year, so you can't credit him for everything that came in the next couple of years. But even as a fan, you can sense that something had changed, and I think because he was there, it allowed the Mets to be able to make a trade for someone like Gary Carter. Because the Mets became a destination place again, and fairly quickly because of what you guys did in 84. And, and you were part of that team and a huge part of that team. And, that was probably the most, it might be the most important team in Mets history, Jay. I mean, you were there. You might agree or disagree, but.
I agree.
Only because it turned to, I mean, there was just this onrushing momentum of awful baseball for so many years. And 84 just reversed that tide. And I get it. There'll be other parts later on, but I mean, that was such an important year to kind of make the Mets relevant again. And I think part of that was the fact that Keith was a part of the team.
And how was he received as a teammate then when you heard we got him? What was it? Remember what the reaction in the locker room was?
Well, it was utter disbelief, frankly. I was like, why on earth would the defending world champion trade their best player to someone within the division? It just didn't make any sense to me. And I said, well, who do we give up? And I expected half the guys in the clubhouse to go out the door. And, Neil Allen was a good major league pitcher. He was our closer, but certainly not up to Rick Ohmby and Neil Allen. I said, that's it. I mean, no one sold to Neil Allen. But I think what Mike said the word he used, which is perfectly descriptive, is gravitas. He gave us some seriousness. He gave us seriousness about how we went about our job, seriousness about our purpose being there every day. He changed the whole culture of the organization, and not many players can make that claim. So I remember we were in Montreal, as you said, and I remember sitting in the clubhouse in Montreal, looking across the clubhouse, and he was unpacking his stuff, and I'm thinking, boy, you poor son of a gun. I hope you realize what you got yourself into, because this is my fourth year being on bad clubs in New York, and I didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. Now, we had Tom Seaver. Ironically, Tom pitched that night, the first night that Keith was in Montreal with us. But other than that, I mean, Straw had just gotten there in May. I don't think Ronnie is there yet. But, I mean, I think we all had a pretty good idea within the organization what kind of players we had in the minor leagues coming up. And I remember thinking, hey, Keith, you know what? Don't be rash. Wait till you see some of these guys we got coming. You might decide to stay. But, you know, him and I were not I hated him because he was a very difficult guy to get out.
Get him out, right?
Then we became best of friends, almost like brothers. So I think the word gravitas was a perfect description of what he brought to the organization.
And he didn't Seaver say, welcome to the Stems?
Yeah, it's Mets backwards. Yeah.
Mets backwards. Welcome to the Stems. Mike, what was the first game you remember? The first game you saw Keith play?
Yeah, I remember watching on TV the first time that he played. I don't know if it was the day he arrived, the next day. And now that was either McCarver's first or second year in town, right? I mean, he was early in his tenure, but
it was his first.
Yeah, it was his first, right? So, I mean, I he was already somebody that I'm like, wow, this, you know, even just McCarver's arrival. It's funny how all these many different things on different levels kind of signal a difference with the Mets, right? And, you know, it was early in his tenure, but you already knew he was, you know, he was a smart guy to listen to and to learn baseball from. And he was the guy who, you know, right away, I remember saying, you know, take a look at what this guy does at first base. Look at how he does the small things, you know. And I'm not sure the casual baseball fan necessarily would appreciate that, but somebody like me who is a rabid baseball fan, you know, talking about his footwork, talking about the way he played bunts, talking about the way he, you know, was fearless throwing to another base, you know, which you don't get with a lot of even very good first baseman. So that's what I remember most, Jay. Sadly, I think the first time I actually saw him in person would have been on the home opener in 84, and I think I'm pretty sure the score was 10-0.
It was on the road. We lost the
season. No, I mean the home opener in 84. And I think you guys had actually – you lost that opener, but then you came home and you were like 6-2 or 7-1 or something because you had a pretty good run.
Yeah.
Faced the Expos on opening day at home, and Ronnie got lit up, and it was 10-0. But I'm joking about that thing too. But I also remember, I mean, we were there. You know, we wanted to see Keith because he was – you know, we were a bunch of 16-year-old, you know, high school kids who wanted to watch their team become good again. And we immediately knew who, you know, I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know if back in those days it was fashionable to buy jerseys. So I don't know that we all bought our 17 jerseys quite yet. But, I mean, we were certainly there to watch Keith and to watch what was obviously going to be a very exciting team. And so I do remember that part of it.
Eddie Habeck, what was your first? Do you remember any early memories to get from Keith?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the clubhouse in 83, I don't really remember him saying too much in 83. By the time he got there in June, our season was over already, you know, and
68-94.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, we were this June 15th, we were already buried in last place. He didn't really say too much, but I vividly remember starting in day one of spring training in 84. It was like, hey, listen, losing is not acceptable anymore. I mean, up to that time, we would lose a close game and it'd be like, well, you know, the leaders on the club, the veterans would be like, hey, we tried hard and, you know, we came up short. Hey, where are we eating tonight? You know, after that, it was not acceptable. It was like a personal insult to your family when we lost the game. And I remember early in 84, I started out the year in the bullpen. And I remember I came in and I had to get a bunt down in a game and I didn't get the bunt down. And boy, he was waiting for me on the top step. And he's like, what the F are you doing? You got to get that down, you know? And I didn't really work that hard on my bunting up to then. But I remember thinking, now, who are you to tell me? But then it sunk in. It's like, hey, this is what leadership is all about, telling you things you don't want to hear at times, that things you need to do to win games. So I worked very hard on my bunting with Bud Harrelson, and that's what leaders do. They push you to make yourself better. You see what's possible with guys like that. You know, you see the way he goes about his business and you want to be the same kind of guy.
Mike, was he one of your go-to guys, you know, in later years? I mean, for your writing stuff? I mean, he always used to sit in front of his locker with a can of Yoo-Hoo, you know, digest, celebrating the game.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jamie. But believe it or not, I mean, sad as it is to say, I'm too young to have ever covered him as a player. But the answer to your question is yes, because later on he became one of my go-to guys in terms of, you know, when he was back working for the Mets, and by this time I was working at the Post. One of the first things I did when he came back to the Mets was introduce myself, and of course I gave him the whole background of how much, you know, we became friends pretty quickly. I think I might have been the first person, in fact I know it was the first person, but almost 20 years ago to say the Mets should retire at 17. So he and I certainly became friendly after that one. But he became my go-to guy in terms of, look, not only talking, you know, giving a voice of authority whenever I would write a historical piece about those teams in the 80s and what they meant to New York and what they meant to baseball, but he also became certainly, you know, in the early days of my time at the Post when I was still kind of, you know, working my way around baseball, and I never actually worked a baseball beat. You know, I came up through basketball, you know, before I got a column. And so, you know, he kind of became a teacher in some ways for me. I would just ask him questions. You know, if I saw him in the dining room before a game or after a game, or, you know, to me, he was a lot more useful to find, you know, just basic information about, you know, the proper ways of doing things in baseball than even some of the guys who were managing the team at the time. So the answer to your question is yes, although not as a beat writer. I mean, I know he was legendary among my colleagues. I mean, you know, obviously Clappish can go chapter and verse about how often he used Keith as a source, both on and off the record sometimes, you know, and how useful he was, and not just in terms of getting a back page, but in terms of understanding the ins and outs of not only that team, but any team in the workings of a baseball team.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And how did the friendship develop? You know, the Rusty's Tom eating place at the Ribs, you, Rusty, Ronnie, and Keith. I mean, how did that develop through the years?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. Number one, you know, we had in 1984, I think we had like 18 single guys on the team. And Keith and I and Rusty all lived in Manhattan. The other guys couldn't afford to live in Manhattan. And I was making good enough money where I could go out to dinner with Rusty and Keith, you know. So we had our dinners on Sunday night at Tokubai in Manhattan. That was our big thing. And on the road, we go out and eat. And the other guys, these young guys, I mean, they were so much younger than the three of us. They didn't want to go out with three old guys, and they couldn't afford to go out and eat with us. So, I mean, the three of us became extremely close. And then after Rusty left, after the 85 season, you know, I was only there for half the year in 86, but Keith and our relationship just continued to evolve over the years, you know, when I went to law school and then I got in the front office, and I, like Mike said, I would call him and ask, you know, why did this guy do that in the game? And he always had an answer for me. So I think we're just alike. We're similar in age. We're, you know, he was a big Raiders fan. I was a Dolphin fan. He came down to Miami in the off season, watched football, and we just had so much in common. So our friendship really did grow over the years.
Before I get to the next topic, I got to tell my Rick Ownby story. It involves George Vesey. Rick Ownby's claim to fame was he worked at a doorknob factory. So I saw the great George Vesey at the Times, a column on Rick Ownby making doorknobs. Yeah, before, about a month before we traded, he's never, ever let me forget it. Every time we sell me another Rick Ownby story, and he was a big blonde-head guy, you know, and he made doorknobs. I mean, you know, me and my wife set the humor. That was a perfect article for me.
That's great.
That's like the second best off the field Mets profession ever, behind Richie Hebner and being a grave digger, right?
Yeah. I want to talk Hall of Fame if we can. So, 5 All-Star teams, 2 Silver Sluggers, 17 years, .296 batting average, over 2,000 hits, over 1,000 RBIs, World Series MVP, 2. World Series championships. Why is it, you know, like he couldn't even get on the ballot for the contemporary committee last time, and he's not eligible again to 225. You know, I've been around, not as much as you guys, but you need an advocate in these things. Like, with no offense to Harold Baines, but Harold Baines got in a couple of years ago. He had a couple of advocates on a committee. It took Gil Hodges 35 votes before Joe Torre was able to get the story straight, and he got in. Does Keith have any hope? He's not eligible to 2025 again. What's your guys' feeling on that?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, at the start, I'll say I had the opportunity to vote for him five times when I first got a Hall of Fame vote. I voted for him all five times. Again, I never covered him, so, I mean, that's pretty, and that's part of the weirdness of the voting bodies. A lot of times you have guys who are voting for guys they never covered or went around, you know. It's an ever-shifting voting body when it comes to the baseball writers portion of the Hall of Fame ballot. But I think he does have a shot. And I was actually stunned that he wasn't on the ballot just passed, only because Mattingly was. And usually when you discuss one's candidacy, you automatically discuss the others because they're so closely entwined, not only as contemporaries, but also as guys who would be the definition of borderline Hall of Famers, although I would argue that both are on the proper side of that border. I think once he gets on the committee ballot, which he will eventually, I think he's got a good chance for two reasons. One, because I think those people are less married, you know, those voters are less married to modern stat work, you know. And even with that, Keith does very well. Even with modern advanced analytics, he does pretty well. I mean, it's just that when he was playing, that wasn't anything that anybody really thought about. But
so 11 gold gloves too. I didn't feel like.
And that, of course, and of course, that, and I think anybody with any kind of sense of the game in the years he played, you know, between 1977 and 1990, around there, understands that he was definitely one of the best players in the game that year. I think that's going to matter. I also think, and this is, you know, I mean, this is probably damning with faint praise, but look, you mentioned Harold Baines, but I mean, to me, you know, Ted Simmons is a Hall of Famer. Ted Simmons was an excellent baseball player. Simmons was also a longtime Cardinal, so there's a real comparison there. And I don't know a Cardinals fan alive who would tell me that Simmons was a better player than Keith Hernandez. And I think that stuff matters. Once you have precedence for players who get in, like Baines and like Ted Simmons, I think that's going to help Keith's case once he gets on the ballot. I still have no understanding why he wasn't on this last ballot. I mean, you know, Mattingly didn't get on, so he might not have gotten in. But, I mean, you still need to have an opportunity to vote for this guy.
Hey, what's your view?
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, if you look at the three or four important things, defense, offense, leadership, and how, as Mike said, how he compares to other Hall of Famers. Now, if you look at his 11 gold gloves, that's only matched by four other guys in the history of baseball: Brooks Robinson, Ozzie Smith, Roberto Clemente, and Willie Mays. That's a pretty good group, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. Except for Keith, the all-time gold glove winners at every position on the field is in the Hall of Fame, except him. And then the other part of it on the, as you said, the awards, but durability. I can tell you, this guy played every day. During that the 12-year span, 1976 to 1987, he played more games than Mike Schmidt, Dave Winfield, and Jim Rice. You know, he was a cornerstone of two World Series champions. He's in the Hall of Fame of two different franchises. How many guys can say that? And as Mike said, you know, he does okay with the analytics. You know, of all the Gold Glove leading Hall of Fame infielders, Keith is second in batting average, number one in OPS, and number one in OPS plus. And as Mike said, Ted Simmons had the quote where analytics got me into the Hall of Fame, and he cited two different categories of that: on base percentage and WAR. And if anybody ever figures out what WAR means, please tell me. But you know, Keith beats him in both of those. So I mean, there's precedent, there's comparison. I've talked about the intangibles, but the tangibles are there also. So you know, I just hope that people look at this dispassionately and passionately, because I think he ranks up there in both of those categories.
And here's just two other things I want to add too. Just, I mean, and again, I mean, these are just things that are add-ons to his candidacy and to his campaign. You know, one, I mean, the man played two game seven of the World Series in his life and had probably the biggest hit in both of those games, you know,
right,
for two different teams, you know. And I think one of the reasons why Mets fans love him is there's an image that's unforgettable for Mets fans of that era, of him in Game 7 getting that big hit that ties the – I think it tied the game, right? He broke the ice. One, it was a huge game. It was a huge hit. And just, when he gets to second base, he's like – and also he had a big hit. He had a huge hit in Game 6 against the Astros too. So these all things, need, I think they need to be a factor. Also, look, I mean, bad timing, bad luck, what have you. I mean, he really could have. You can make a serious argument that he should have won the MVP in 84. Ryan Sandberg had a great year, so he was definitely a worthy winner. But now if you're talking about a two-time MVP, how do you keep that guy out of the Hall of Fame? And he didn't miss out winning that MVP by that much. And as a guy who probably watched 140 of those games, of your games that year, Ed, I can tell you I've never seen a guy more valuable to a team than that guy was in 1984.
You know, when I look back in 86, in the seventh, in game six against Houston, when Jesse Orosco struggled on the mound, you know, Keith goes to the mound, probably the greatest pitcher confrontation on the mound, and he says to Jesse, if you throw another fastball, I'll kill you. And that was what he did all the time.
There might have been another word in there, right?
Yes, another word. Look, let me, in honesty, we know Keith has some troubles off the field. Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
Do you think that factors into it at all? I mean, what's your gut with that?
I sometimes wonder that, but look, for better or for worse, we tend to give guys who have had substance abuse problems far more of a pass than we give guys who decided to use steroids. That's fact, because there are guys who, you know, spent time, you know, in rehab or publicly battling their substance abuse demons who are in the Hall of Fame. Maybe they had to wait a little extra. Maybe, you know, I won't name them just to embarrass them, but we all know who they are. And it wasn't a secret. That's just they're in the Hall. It was a different standard. So, I mean, I think that might have been a reason why, you know, and sometimes voters hold back because of certain reasons, so they won't vote them on the first time or the third time. I don't think that's the deciding factor for a lot of guys. I know he was, maybe his was more public than others, but I mean, I think that he served a long and meritorious penance after the Pittsburgh trials, and clearly never, was never anywhere near trouble again from that standpoint. So
in my experience, guys, with Gil Hodges, having a champion on a committee means so much. Not to bore you, so Ferguson Jenkins was on a committee. We had Cleon Jones call Ferguson Jenkins to talk about Gil, and it just plays so much of an important thing. Who's voting? You know, you got to get 12 or 16 votes, and this ballot is really stacked, a contemporary ballot. I mean, supposedly other guys left off, but so you really guys think that and it's 2025. I think it's 2025. I wrote down.
I think you're right. I think it's every 3 years.
That he's got it. Time will make it better for him, not worse.
Well, I think, you know, I had lunch with Josh Rawitz, the president of the Hall of Fame, about a month ago. And we talked, we went through all of this. And we talked about some other players. I said, why is this not? I'm not going to bring any names up, but why isn't this guy in the Hall of Fame? Why isn't that guy in the Hall of Fame? And he said, well, they had some off-field things. And some of the things were pretty heinous stuff. You know, I'm talking about, you know, domestic battery, things of that nature, you know, and, you know, Keith has served his time. He's served his time. And this, we're talking about almost 40 years ago. And his life since then has been pristine and perfect on and off the field. And, you know, I never saw any of that stuff that came up in the Pittsburgh drug trial. When he came to New York, he was ready to play every day. Never saw any hint of any kind of substance abuse. Nothing. Zero. And we're talking almost 40 years ago. Actually 40 years ago. So
we ask guys to be accountable all the time, right? I mean, it's more accountable than raising your right hand and swearing under oath that you were a drug addict at one point. I mean, he did that.
That's right.
He stood up and he owned it. He acknowledged it. And for, as Ed said, for the last 40 years, you know, he's you know, essentially,
the night before he left to go to Pittsburgh, I think he got four hits. And we were in San Diego, and he got four
hits.
Remember
that night?
And when he came back, he said, "Listen, I want to do this the right way." We put all the writers up to Arthur Richmond's suite, and he said, "I did what I did," and he spilled the beans. He said, "I did it," and you know, but look, anybody see this guy play? There's nobody better on and off the field. And, you know, Davey Johnson trusted implicitly with his team. He made him the first Mets captain. And hopefully in a couple of years he'll get his rightful due.
I think it's fair to say if he wasn't the best defensive first baseman who ever lived, he's in the top two or three. I think that's fair.
That's more than fair, yes.
I happen to think, I didn't see a George Sisler play, but, I mean, you know, I happen to think that should count for something. Bill Mazeroski is in the Hall of Fame Yes, he had a famous home run, but he's in the Hall of Fame because he was acknowledged as the best defensive second baseman of all time to that point. And so if that's going to be a standard, especially among the veterans committee who voted Mazeroski in, then being the best first defensive first baseman of all time ought to matter in Keith's win column there.
And you know, Randy, you can agree. Keith doesn't get paid. Listen, he wants it. Yeah, you know, but he doesn't go blatantly, I should be in the Hall of Fame. He, you know, whatever happens, happens. He's not an ego guy at all. You know, listen, I hope it gets it too. Listen, you guys are both busy. I want to thank you very much, Mike Kennedy, for your time. And I hope to see you guys too. And thank you for doing this. And you know, happy anniversary to Keith on June 15th, 1983.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jay. Thank you for your time, guys. I really appreciate it.